Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president, Local 237. With us once again is our very special guest, the governor of New York State, Governor Kathy Hochul. She is the first female governor of New York State and also the 57th governor in New York State history. Governor, welcome to Reaching Out.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be back on the show again. I always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I believe you've been on our show at least seven times.
Quite a few times.
So I think you're our most featured guest.
Thank you.
So we're going to begin. You've been very vocal about the need for public safety and gun violence protection. In your hometown of Buffalo, New York, last year there was a horrific mass shooting, and I know that you did not like seeing the mass shooting in New York State, because New York State has always been on the forefront of making sure that these tragedies don't happen by having strict gun laws. Tell us some of the most important initiatives that will help to make New Yorkers feel safe.
You know, Greg, I appreciate that question. Public safety is my most important, highest priority. And every single day, we're trying to find different ways to deal with the crime spike in areas where it's going up and areas where we can drive it down. But also, so you have the everyday violence, which continues. But also this mass shooting, as you mentioned, 1 year ago, literally 1 year ago this week, we honored the lives of those we lost when I was back in Buffalo, actually on Mother's Day. So it was a real sad day for the families left behind from those 10 people who simply were going to a grocery store on a Saturday afternoon and were targeted because of their color by a bigot, a white supremacist, who was radicalized online. So I just made those ceremonies. Reverend Al Sharpton was there. He came up. Kamala Harris came up. President Biden came up over a period of days. So the whole world was focused on what happened in Buffalo. I came back to Albany and sat down with our leaders and said, we have to make changes. We may think we have the toughest gun laws, except this was an individual who was wearing an armored vest that was legal. The security guard could have stopped him if he wasn't wearing that vest. So we then banned those vests. We also said, why is an 18-year-old able to buy a military-style assault weapon? What on earth? So we said you have to be at least 21. Now, I personally would ban them, but given that we can't under federal law, we said raise it to 18. We enhanced our background checks. We did more on dealing with ghost guns, those guns you can order online and make a gun in your house, and it can be a lethal weapon. We also worked on red flag laws. Let me explain what that is, because it's made an extraordinary difference. This is for people that have been determined to be capable of committing violence to themselves or to others. And if you have a suspicion, you're a teacher, someone in law enforcement, you have a right to get a judge to say, we have to see whether this person has access to guns. We have identified 9,500 times in the last year alone where people had guns removed because they could have used them for harm. So think about all the cases we've now prevented. So I will close by just simply saying, in my budget we just wrapped up, we have over $800 million to help support the violence disruptor programs, the former gang members who come back and use their knowledge of the streets to keep people from making the wrong decisions, trying to prevent crimes, after school programs, jobs for people, giving people an alternative, but also helping our district attorneys, giving them significant money, changing the bail laws, which was important. So judges now have the discretion to look at the whole case, what happened, what the history was a gun involved, was it related to domestic violence, and make the decision that will protect the community. So we did a lot on this. We're not done yet, but we're heading in the right direction.
Now, you mentioned violence interrupters. Can you tell us a little more about that program? And secondly, can you tell us about the new law or the changes to the law that allows judges to look at the total case? And right, I mean, Part C. Give us before the law was changed and the difference after.
Well, let's talk. You talk about the bail laws.
Yes.
A number of years ago, there was a decision made to add a lot more crimes to the category of not being bail eligible. Some were very serious offenses, and the judge's hands were tied. They weren't able to look at, you know, is there a history? Was a gun involved? Was there? Is it at a schoolyard? A lot of circumstances where anybody would say, you know, that went a little too far. We need to make sure that judges now can look at the whole picture and see whether or not they did harm to a person, harm to property, looking at more factors than they were before. And we got that change, and that literally just went into effect. So we've not had a chance to see those changes. I will say the reason those changes were made in the first place was that we want to make sure that our criminal justice system is also fair, that two people accused of the same offense, someone steals something from a store, if one person has money, their parents can bail them out and they can go back home, they'd be back to their jobs, back to school, and their lives go on until they have their court appearance. If someone doesn't have money, they can be sitting in Rikers for a very long time waiting for their day in court. We changed that so those low-level offenses are treated differently now, and that's a good outcome. But what I was concerned with, and what a lot of people said went too far, was this taking away the ability of a judge to look at all the factors. So now we have the ability of a judge to look at the whole story, the individual, and find ways, you know, does this person need help themselves? You know, is there mental health problems? Do they need substance abuse? Why are they committing these crimes? But also get them help. At the same time, protect the community, that if they really are going to do harm, they should not be walking the streets committing more crimes during the time before they have their day in court. So that was behind the bail laws. The violence disruptor programs have been around a long time, but they didn't have enough money. When I first became governor, they had about $6 million statewide to fund them. I tripled that. I have put a lot more money toward these groups that work in communities. They work in partnership with law enforcement, and many of them are part of groups of people who had been justice involved. They may have done time in jail. They know the temptations. They know why people make the wrong decisions, particularly earlier in life, young males. And they're helping them. They're being mentors to them and helping them see a different path. That's one way, when they're working well, that we can stop people from starting a life of crime, letting them know that they can have a healthier, better life if they get into a job training program or simply stay in school and have an adult who actually looks out for them and cares for them. That's behind that. Some are affiliated with churches, which I think is really important. Churches are often the place that people turn to. I go to a lot of churches. Many times it's the moms and grandmas sitting there, but they are influencers on the children in their care as well, and they can help let them be connected to these groups. So we're trying to sort of an all-of-the-above approach. There's not one way to solve the crime problem or to make people feel safe, even our subways. I was on the subway yesterday. We have added more police officers than ever before, so you have announcements saying that there's a police officer on this train or there's a police officer on the platform, and we now have cameras in the subway trains. So people know that they're being watched, that they're going to do some harm to someone, that they will be seen. And lastly, for people who have mental health problems, we put $1 billion in our budget to help people, because some of these people are on the streets, they're on the subways. Sometimes they have an episode, and we had that experience most recently, and you know, dire consequences have occurred, and we want to prevent that by investing more in mental health, getting people off the streets, into supportive housing, into programs that can help them lead a healthy life. So it's really the whole picture of looking at individuals, their communities, temptations that exist on the streets, the access to guns, giving them better opportunities, and really a more optimistic outlook in life. And that's how we're going to be continuing to focus on all the ways we can reduce crime in our state.
Now, you mentioned cameras in the subway cars. Does New York City transit system now feature a camera in every subway car?
No, we started the process. It takes about 18 months to finish it. This was part of what I announced with Mayor Adams in October, when we wanted to focus on how to make the subways safer, because crime had been going up. We have reduced that number. It has gone down. I'm glad to see that. I want to see it go down even more. But by and large, they are much safer than they had been, and the cameras are installed in many, but not all of them yet.
Oh, that's a very good idea to have a subway camera. I mean, a camera installed in every subway car.
There will be. Yes.
Yeah, that's very good. That's a very good idea. Tell us more about the accessing mental health services provided supports for supportive services in schools, as well as the criminal justice system.
You know, that, Greg, you make an excellent point. I think before the pandemic, we wouldn't have talked so much about this. Schools may have a counselor, maybe they have their guidance counselor. They focus on what happens when the children leave school. Now we have such a problem after the pandemic. So many kids fell between the cracks during that time when they had to get remote learning. They didn't always have a parent there making sure that they were paying attention. They didn't always even have access to a computer or a cell phone where they can connect to the teacher. So they lost a lot of learning, but they also lost something important. They lost a connection to normalcy. Their lives were so disrupted. They're surrounded, especially in the city, by family members, grandparents who lost their lives to COVID. The sirens were constantly going. There was such a heightened stress, and it really took a toll on our children. Our teachers have been doing incredible work to try and help bring our kids back up, but they need professional help in our schools. We put $34.5 billion toward education, record amount of money. Schools have never seen as much money to allow teachers to do the best they can to help give kids a great outcome. But meanwhile, we need to have mental health providers in the schools to help identify the kids with problems, because if you can treat and prevent a problem in a child, you stop a lifetime of needing assistance and outcomes that could lead to crime or homelessness. And we can stop that by helping out in the schools early on. It's also about getting supportive housing, as I mentioned, getting people off the streets into wraparound services that help them treat their illness, but also then help them find a job and make sure that they have regular communication with a mental health provider who can talk to them. Even with, you think about the Zoom calls, you can have a conversation with a therapist or a psychologist, psychiatrist. You can have that communication without having to go to an office. So it is much easier, but we have a lot more work to do for society as a whole, but particularly our kids, to help them recover from the pandemic and lead healthier lives.
Very good, very good, very good. Public housing in New York City was once a source of pride for both residents and workers. But federal funding has diminished over the years, and aging buildings are in need of repair, major repair. Your administration has taken many steps to helping NYCHA back to its glory days. Tell us about some of your initiatives.
Well, you're absolutely right. There was decades of neglect. People just decided that these individuals weren't worth the effort and the money, and it was tragic. It was a disgrace how people in NYCHA housing have been treated through the decades. So we wanted to show that these individuals matter. They don't deserve to live in squalor conditions. The elevators should work. There should not be asbestos. It should not be lead. It should be clean. The light should be fixed in the hallways. And a lot of that goes to public safety. So we invested in, I believe you were there, Greg, talking about how we unlocked the federal dollars by changing the law in the state, what they call the Public Housing Trust. And through that trust, it'll lead to decades of money being available for the repairs even. And we think it could unlock billions of dollars to go into the NYCHA buildings and bring them up to the standards that we would expect everyone in New York to be entitled to. So that's one part of what we did last year. But also, we mentioned the pandemic earlier. A lot of people fell behind on their rent because they lost their job or they were sick and had to take care of a family member, whatever reason. And there was money available through the federal government last year to help people get caught up on their rent, pay the landlords, except it wasn't available for residents of public housing. So people are getting anxious. Bills are piling up. The anxiety is off the charts. So we put $400 million in our budget just passed to help people who are behind in their rent in public housing. So that's going to go a long way as well as for people, $130 million in capital investments, another $135 million. Again, to make the repairs that need to be made, and then programs to help people maintain repairs and others areas where houses can decline, not just in NYCHA housing, but other housing, that people are homeowners. It's a huge source of pride, but it's very expensive to fix your house. So we've been working hard on tenant protections, making sure that we have money for tenants who are behind in the rent, and not forgetting the 340,000 people who live in NYCHA housing.
Also, in terms of affordable housing, what is being done to help more New Yorkers have access to housing they can afford?
Well, if you listen to my State of State address and my budget, you saw that I had a very expansive, bold plan to build over 800,000 units over the next decade. The way we can drive down the cost of housing, especially rentals, is to have more supply. It's simple supply and demand. Prices go down the more supply you have. And so we have the exact opposite. We have a tight supply because we've not been building. We've not been creative. We've not unleashed all the possibilities that exist that I tried with the legislature to get through. And there was a lot of resistance, even to office conversions. Think about this. We've got buildings all over the city of New York. They're not filled anymore because people are working remotely. Why not create an incentive for developers to convert them to housing? We could add thousands and thousands of units. Again, more units come on, the prices start going down. Also, accessory dwelling units. We talk about those. That's letting your kids after school, when they can't find a job, live in your basement legally, or be able to rent it out to another family member. Let your parents or grandparents live with you so they can help take care of the kids. But that's prohibited right now. And something as simple as that, you know, has not been embraced thus far. We hope we can get that through next time. But also asking communities to meet growth targets. This is a little bit tougher. People didn't want to be told what to do, but they're not doing it on their own. So I've been told I'm the first governor in 50 years to pay attention to housing. And I think there's too many exclusionary zoning rules that are set up to keep people out. And that's not acceptable in this day and age. We have to embrace diversity, allow people to come, build housing. And why not build more housing around our train stations? You think about many of our train stations have an empty parking lot at the end of the day when people are done using it. Why can't that space be used to build multi-levels, first floor coffee shops, a little bakery, a little retail? Then you can put a couple layers of parking above it. You can double, triple the amount of parking available, and then put housing above that. So the space is there, the opportunities are there. We just need the political will to get it done. I have it. I'm working with the legislature over the next year when they're out of session. They leave in June, trying to build a coalition of people who believe in what we're trying to do. It'll put a lot of people to work. It is good for the economy. It'll help us catch up with places like New Jersey and Connecticut that have far outpaced us in building, which again is why we're losing the race. People are leaving our state because they can't afford housing, and the reason is we didn't build it. So I want to just keep fighting, powering through this. It's not easy, but I didn't sign up for easy. Being governor is not supposed to be easy. We embrace the challenges and try to solve all the problems that are out there.
Now, that's an interesting statement that you just made. You didn't sign up for easy. Being governor is not easy. And a lot of people take political positions and lay back and thinking the work gets done magically. And the reality is you're not here to be a star. You're here to do the work. And if you're not here to do the work, you shouldn't take the job. And I like that statement. That's a very good statement. It's a very good quote to live by.
Thank you very much. You know, I believe in public service, and there are so many different ways, even through our budget, we can transform people's lives. We just gave people a pay increase. People are struggling so much. Our families in New York trying to figure out how to manage with inflation, the cost of diapers and formula and the kids' sneakers and backpacks and the cost of eggs. It is too much for people on top of the high cost of their rent, their housing unit or their mortgage if they are fortunate to have a house. So we decided that we increase the minimum wage and for the first time in state history, index it to inflation. So when prices go up, people's salaries go up or income goes up. So that's really going to set us apart and continuing our legacy of being a progressive state that takes care of our people.
Very good. The MTA ridership is down, and so is its revenue. What are your plans to improve both?
Well, yesterday I took the 4-5 train down to the MTA meeting. Had a great experience checking out the subway firsthand. And what I was able to do when I got to the meeting was talk about how we invested in the future of the MTA. I said, failure is not an option. We can't say there's just not enough money, let's shut it down, because otherwise we're basically saying, let's shut down New York City and ultimately New York State. So yes, ridership is down. That really hurt our revenues dramatically. But what I did was said, let's put together a 4-year plan. Let's not kick the can down the road anymore. Let's take this seriously and problem solving. Money from the state, money from the city, money from a payroll mobility tax, which the largest employers would be paying in the city, as well as even looking at possible revenues from casinos that will come eventually to downstate. So we put together a whole package that'll help sustain the MTA in the future. And ultimately, with congestion pricing, we'll be able to have the money to make more investments, to expand the lines, and to add in more handicap accessible elevators, and do all the things we need to do to keep this lifeblood of our region, get that blood pumping through it. It's been a hard hit for the MTA. It really has. No one anticipated that 3 years ago we'd find ourselves in this situation. But people are starting to come back. They are feeling safer. The train was packed when I was on it yesterday, and people are feeling better again, knowing that there's police officers around. They're starting to take the subway again. But it does feel like New York is back. The streets are crowded. The buses are running. We also are looking at an experiment, a pilot program, to see what would happen if we have free buses. Would that get more people off the streets and help people who are struggling, make it a little bit easier on them? So we have 5 different lines, one in each of the boroughs. We're going to be testing a pilot program on free buses. So we're doing a lot with transportation.
That's very good. And you mentioned the free buses. How would someone access this? I know it's a pilot program, but tell us how that works.
We're still developing that right now, trying to identify the 5 lines, but they're very excited about it at the MTA. And again, the MTA is just head over heels happy that they don't have to worry hour by hour, do they have enough money to keep the lights on and the trains running. So we're focused on a lot of ideas, but getting more people taking the buses and keeping the bus lanes clear. We're going to be doing a lot more enforcement in the bus lanes so they can go faster. Sometimes you're sitting on a bus, if they see the people on the street walking faster than the bus is going. So we have to unlock the logjam in our city streets and the gridlock, because otherwise, delivery services can't get through, and our economy really slows down, because we need to be able to move people and move products, and that's what New York is all about.
Now, have you made this announcement about the pilot program for the free buses, or is this the first time you're making?
Well, I like to make news with you, Greg. It was in our budget.
Oh, thank you. But that's where I want to know. I was waiting for an exclusive, and you gave it to us.
They're still looking at we announced it in our budget, but yes, there has not been a lot of attention on it. So you're the one spotlighting it.
Oh,
and
right.
Also, we have not identified the 5 lines yet.
So I understand. It's in the infancy stages, but you made the announcement here. It's going to happen. You're going to identify the lines, and there's going to be a pilot program of free bus transportation. And that's
we'll have you on one of the first buses, Greg. So we can see.
I would love to participate. Love to participate. Okay. Come on that bus and ride the bus.
That'd be great.
Free transportation. Thank you. And unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this segment of Reaching Out. Governor, you're welcome to come back anytime you want to come back. Unscheduled, scheduled, you just say if you want something, if you have something that you want to make an announcement about, and you don't want a lot of political questions and a lot of angst, you can always come back on the Reaching
Out. That's an offer I'll take you up on, Greg. Glad to have you. And thank you for all the work you're doing, not just with the show, but representing the men and women of New York. So thank you.
Thank you. And that's all the time we have for this segment of Reaching Out. Our special guest was Governor Kathy Hochul, New York State Governor. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237. The preceding pre-recorded program paid for by Teamsters Local 237.